Recording in progress.
Well, good evening, good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see so many of you. Thanks for coming. It's always good to get together to contemplate the Dharma. And I enjoy it a lot, and I'm never sure whether we're learning anything, but I'm sure we are trying to learn something, which is even better. So today I want to talk about the main body of the text of the Awakening of Faith. We've been sort of talking about the preliminary chapters. And I was saying last time that there are five parts, and part three is called interpretation. And that's the main part. Of course, it itself is divided into a lot of different parts and subparts, which are divided into further subparts. It's a little bit dizzying. It's like Russian dolls, you know, one inside the other, inside the other, inside the other. In other words, it's a very systematic and logical text, which is not the usual way that we think in Zen. I mean, this is not a Zen text per se, Chinese Buddhist text, but not a Zen text. And also, this kind of systematic way is not my usual way of thinking either, so I've had to really challenge myself to keep it all straight. And I'm going to try tonight to be as clear, you know, about where we are in the text as I can be. Which means, and I'm warning you in advance, that this is going to be a very technical and boring Dharma talk. And I hope that you will be okay with that. But I thought that given that, we'll take little breaks to just sit and breathe in between sections so it doesn't get too tedious. Okay, so part three, interpretation, consists of three chapters. The first chapter, Revelation of True Meaning. Second chapter, Correction of Evil Attachments. And the third chapter, Analysis of Types of Aspiration for Enlightenment. So the first chapter, Revelation of True Meaning, is the longest one because this is the one where our author or authors attempt to systematize the most important aspects of the Mahayana analysis of reality. So that's what I'm going to get to tonight, but I can't do it's too just that one first chapter is too much to do in one sitting, so I'm going to go through some of it, but not all of it, this chapter called Revelation of True Meaning. And of course, the chapter has subdivisions, three main subdivisions. Number one, one mind and its two aspects. Number two, the essence itself and the attributes of suchness. And number three, from samsara to nirvana. And again, I'm going to cover some, but not all, of the first of these three divisions, one mind and its two aspects, because there's a lot about that. Okay, got all that so far? Now you know exactly where we are and what we're doing, right? Okay, last time we talked about the basic idea of the text, which is mind, with a capital M. And remember, mind doesn't mean consciousness exactly. It sort of does, but really mind is a bigger category than what we think of as consciousness. In this case, mind means reality in all of its visible and invisible, knowable and unknowable aspects. All of reality. And there's lots of mysterious aspects of reality. Now, mind has two sides to it, or two aspects to it, or two ways of talking about it or looking at it. The transcendent way and the phenomenal way, which are defined as being totally different, but in fact, they're identical. And I talked about this at the all-day sitting on Saturday, if you were there or listened to the talk. But in that case, I used different words. Instead of phenomenal and transcendent, I used the words conditioned and unconditioned. But it's the same thing. And that is one mind and two aspects, right? So the awakening of faith goes into lots of interesting detail about this. So of course, one mind and its two aspects is going to have be divided into two parts, right? Part A, the mind in terms of the absolute or the transcendent, and part B, the mind in terms of the phenomenal. Okay, A. The mind in terms of the absolute is here called Dharma Dhatu, the realm of reality, the realm of Dharma, the realm of truth. It's all inclusive. There's nothing that's not part of the Dharma Dhatu. It is defined as being unborn and unperishing, which is to say that from the ordinary point of view, it doesn't, strictly speaking, exactly exist, which is why it could never pass out of existence. That's why it's imperishable, because it's never born. And there are no distinctions in it whatsoever, and that means there are no things in it. There's no objects, there's no entities at all. And that implies, the text tells us, that all verbal descriptions and all perceptions are therefore to be understood as provisional, because all of them are based on illusions. And these illusions do not touch the realm of suchness. And here they introduce another word to indicate the absolute suchness. And they say, the word suchness doesn't tell you anything, it doesn't describe anything. There's no thing that the word suchness refers to. And interestingly, Professor Hakeda, our translator, who, if you've been reading along, you know, he sometimes interrupts the text to give little comments, explanations. And in this case, he tells us that he goes back to Fatsang's commentary, the most famous commentary on the text. And Fatsang says, the functional equivalent of the word suchness is the phrase, shut up. I mean, that's not exactly what Hakeda says, or Fatsang doesn't say that, but in effect, that's what he says. Shut up. Suchness means shut up. In other words, it's a word that doesn't refer to anything, but it indicates this is the end of talking. Because all illusions, all existing things have nothing, there's nothing to be said about them, so suchness is the end of talking. Nothing can be talked about. All talking is essentially just jabbering, like I'm doing now. We're never talking about what is really real, because what is really real cannot be spoken of. So that is a little sobering. Puts things into perspective, you know. Then, as I mentioned last time, one of the devices of the text is that somebody comes along and asks a question to clarify. So somebody comes along and asks the question that you might be having in your mind right now, which is, well, what are we supposed to do with all that? You know, like, what good is that? And the answer is, if people understand when they speak that there's no speaker and nothing spoken of, then they're free from their thoughts and words, even as they're using them. So they can take a great delight and freedom in it all. And if they do, this means they will have absorbed the point. Which is to say that this is not meant to be simply a philosophical point. It's meant to be something that a person can experience, can live. If by experience we stop meaning I am having an experience or somebody is having an experience, but rather we mean just there's experience, something is happening, something is alive right here, which we call I'm having an experience, or we call it this, or we call it that, conventionally, but it isn't that, ever. And although we may be talking, we're always understanding that we cannot really employ words to get at it, or even thoughts and ideas. Next, we learn that the idea of suchness has two aspects, two subplots, right? And they are, number one, it is truly empty. And number two, it is truly not empty. Number one, truly empty means that things are truly empty of any distinctions or any differences. The idea that I am me and you are you, and therefore you are not me and I am not you, is a conventional idea that in fact is empty of any real content. However much we may believe it and act on it, this is the whole problem, right? Because that idea has no reality. Emptiness seems really negative and troubling when you think that there's something that is not empty, and now someone's telling you that it's empty, and you're going to lose that thing that you had before that now is supposed to be empty. And that's why people don't like the word emptiness and find the whole thing, you know, difficult. But when you realize that there is actually nothing that can be negated, and that you're not losing anything because you never had it to begin with, that the very idea of negation is impossible, then this is very uplifting. Because you realize there's no problem, and there never was a problem. And your only thing you're left with is delight and the radical ease of constant connection and constant aliveness. Which brings us to point number two. It is truly not empty. Because once you realize that everything is empty of distinction, once you see that the things you were so troubled by and thought you had or thought were a problem for you were emptied out, and they always were emptied out, then you realize that emptiness means exactly non-emptiness. Things are devoid of illusions. Things are eternal, permanent, immutable, pure, and constantly self-sufficient. They're not at all empty. They're full. That's what emptiness is. Fullness. You'd realize that you had been dividing everything up into little boxes, and it was all troublesome. The boxes were banging into each other, and there weren't enough boxes. There are too many boxes. Then you realize, oh, wait, you know, there were no boxes to begin with. Everything is just completely wonderful as it is. So that's the end of the discussion of point A, the mind in terms of the absolute. Next, we come to the discussion of point B, the mind in terms of phenomena. Now, as you may well imagine, there's a lot more to say about this one because this has to do with the world that we know about, you know, the world that we live in, the ordinary human world of experience and phenomena and so on, which, although it's all illusory, it's very compelling to us, and we have to deal with it, so it has a lot to say about this. But before we go into that, we must pause for a moment to take a breath and digest everything that you just heard. So I'm going to ring the bell. just breathe and try to just see what you have in your mind. Okay, so the discussion of the mind in terms of phenomena, which of course is subdivided into three parts, which are themselves subdivided into various parts. Part one is called the storehouse consciousness. Part two is called the causes and conditions of samsara. And part three is the characteristics of beings in samsara. Okay, so now, first part, the storehouse consciousness. Probably a lot of you have heard about this before, and maybe you've studied it a lot, because it's a term that is part of Yogacara mind-only analysis of mind. So just a little background to simplify it or to inform you if you're not familiar with it. Originally, Buddha proposed a system of understanding our mind based on five skandhas and six consciousnesses. And you're all familiar with them because they're mentioned in the Heart Sutra. The five skandhas are forms, and there are different translations, but the usual ones, usual translation is form, feelings, perceptions, volitions, and consciousness. In the Heart Sutra, when it says form is emptiness, we're always talking about form is emptiness, but it actually doesn't mean form is emptiness only, because the Heart Sutra is an abbreviation. You know, it just it wants to be one page long, so it saves a lot of words. When it says form is emptiness, it means form is emptiness, feelings are emptiness, perceptions are empty, volitions are empty, and consciousness is empty. All five skandhas are empty. It just doesn't want to repeat all that. So form in the Heart Sutra stands for all the skandhas. The fifth skandha is consciousness, and that consciousness is divided into six kinds of consciousness, five consciousnesses associated with the five senses, and a sixth consciousness that's associated with mind. So what we call sight has three elements in order for it to occur. It has an image that is caused by an image that impacts the eye, coming from something that's capable of being seen. Like when you hear a sound is not capable of being seen, but a tree is something capable of being seen. So when the image of a tree hits your eye, it arises, consciousness arises, sight consciousness. And the sixth one is when there's a thought that comes, the thought impacts the mind and consciousness arises, and we say, oh, I'm aware I have a thought. That's mind consciousness. Same with an emotion. We're aware of having emotions because of mind consciousness. And the point of this system of five skandhas is to be able to observe closely human experience without reference to a self, without reference to me or mine. Which is the whole point. Because the Buddha realized that self-clinging is the big problem. It's the basic cause of suffering, so you need a way of accessing your experience without always going through the filter of the self. And that's why the Buddha created the five skandhas and six consciousness as a kind of way of understanding. Then along come the Yogacara pundits, who apparently were very, very sophisticated people with powerful meditation practice an intense self-awareness. And they seem to have the idea that you actually should include in the understanding of consciousness self-consciousness. Since we are having, we think, doesn't it seem like we have some experience of self? We may be drastically mistaken about what that experience is, but, you know, we would all have to say, yeah, it seems like I am me. It seems like I have that feeling. So the Yogacara people said, well, we should make a map of mind that includes that feeling, because we need to deal with it more directly. So they had a scheme of 8 consciousnesses, the 6 that I mentioned already, and they added 2 more. Mano-vijnana, the word vijnana means consciousness, mano-vijnana, which means basically self-consciousness, and the 8th consciousness, alaya-vijnana. And alaya means storehouse. So storehouse consciousness is the 8th consciousness, very famous. Storehouse consciousness is the sum total of all consciousness. It includes the material world, which is considered to be a slower and more gross form of consciousness, a different form of consciousness than other forms, but nevertheless also a form of consciousness. That's why I was saying on Saturday, according to Buddhism, there is no material world apart from consciousness. The thing about storehouse consciousness, though, even though it's all-inclusive, it has the, tragically, has the capacity to be fundamentally deluded and fundamentally to create suffering. And so, in the Yogacara system, the goal of practice is to turn the storehouse consciousness around, to reverse it or revert it from the projection of outward delusion to the inner turning of awakening to absolute identity. However, Professor Hakeda mentions that we shouldn't pay too much attention to this because, and I feel this as I read the text, you know, because the awakening of faith uses all terms in slightly different ways. You know, and you don't know, at least to me, I don't know whether, like, the authors are just ignorant and they don't know the way the terms are usually used, or they purposely don't want to get caught in the usual, for their own reasons, they want to use these terms differently. But anyway, they use them slightly differently. This is a very non-standard text, even though, as I say, it became very standard and popular in Chinese Buddhism. But to my knowledge, anyway, which is not that great, seems like it's a little out of step with mostly what you read about these things. Anyway, to introduce the idea of storehouse consciousness, the text simply says that people develop a false sense of separate identity based on this deep ingrained perversion or inversion, maybe, at the heart of the storehouse consciousness. And then the text goes on to a much deeper discussion of how this is so, which, of course, will include various subtopics and subtopics. So the 3 subtopics are A. Now it gets confusing, because now before we had the capital letter A, now we have the small letter A, right? Just like we have Roman numeral 1 and then we have small letter 1 to indicate, right? You've seen that in outlines, right? So the 3 subtopics are small letter A, the absolute mind and the mind of phenomena are capital A and capital B, but here we have small letter A. So the small letter A, 3 divisions, subtopics now under the category of storehouse consciousness, alaya-vijnana. A, the enlightened aspect, B, the unenlightened aspect, and C, the relationship between the unenlightened and the enlightened aspect. So now we're getting down to cases. This is the stuff we want to know about, right? Because this is our problem. Now we're getting down to a direct discussion of, like, what's wrong here? Okay, A, the enlightened aspect of storehouse consciousness, wouldn't you know it, it itself has three subdivisions. You with me? Small number one. One, original enlightenment. So this is the enlightened aspect of the storehouse consciousness, which is, anyway, three subdivisions. Number one, original enlightenment. Number two, the process of actualizing enlightenment. And number three, the characteristics of the essence of enlightenment. Okay, so maybe we'll learn something here that we can really listen to. Okay, original enlightenment. So original enlightenment is actually mind itself, the whole thing, with a capital M. Because mind itself is, by its nature, awakening. It's awakened. I mean, it is beyond distinctions. It's eternal. It's perfect. So it doesn't need to get enlightened. It already has that nature. This is the Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. So getting enlightenment or getting enlightened is a little bit of a come down, right, for mind, which doesn't need any of that. And this is something that Dogen talks about all the time when he's always talking about going beyond Buddha or going beyond enlightenment. You've noticed, if you read Dogen, that he says that a lot. Because Buddha or enlightenment are very small bore, because the picture is much bigger than that. And the passage I quoted from Suzuki Roshi at the sitting last Saturday is about this. This is what he means. Remember, I said he's talking about the difference between letting the heat kill you versus just become a hot Buddha. The hot Buddha is original enlightenment. It's already there. You just be hot. You're already a Buddha. There's nothing to overcome. You don't need to achieve enlightenment, because that's extra. Attaining enlightenment, Suzuki Roshi says, is extra. Don't bother with it. You don't need that. And the trouble with it, the trouble with focusing on attaining enlightenment, is that it's very likely that that will only encourage self-clinging and complicate the problem. So that's original enlightenment. Now, just because we have original enlightenment, of course, doesn't mean we don't have to practice. Because, although the nature of mind is enlightenment, and we are already enlightenment, also, an aspect of mind is that it is constantly in the process of actualizing enlightenment. Because of the perverse and beginningless ignorance that's all knotted up and twisted up at the very base of the storehouse consciousness. So the actualization of enlightenment is something that occurs. So what is that process? And here, the awakening of faith gives us a definition of that that I think is really important. To me, this seems like the most important thing in the whole text. And here's what it says. The process of actualization of enlightenment, this is a direct quote from the English translation, the process of actualization of enlightenment is nothing other than integrating the identity with original enlightenment. So I'm going to say that again, because that seems like so fundamental, so important, and so realistic. The process of actualization of enlightenment is nothing other than integrating the identity with original enlightenment. And when you consider the identity that you think you have now, it's definitely not integrated with original enlightenment, right? It's integrated with all kinds of nasty conditioning and troublesome things, but not with original enlightenment. And that also is what Suzuki Roshi was talking about in the passage that I quoted for you on Saturday. He's saying there, little by little, day by day, through all the things we do in our practice, you are integrating into your sense of identity the actual fact, which is a true fact, that you really are Buddha. And you just need to relax into that reality. So that's point number two. The actualization of enlightenment, a really important point for us. And therefore, an excellent time to stop and breathe and just see what's going on. Okay, next the text goes into what to me is a little bit murky and obscure discussion of exactly how that takes place. And this is a kind of framework that I am totally unfamiliar with, and it could come from somewhere else, or it might be unique to this text. And the framework uses that ancient and very traditional early Buddhist explanation of how a moment arises and passes away. A moment arises and passes away. Early on, the Buddha taught that a moment of time, and remember, there's nothing but moments of time. In other words, there's no things. Everything is a momentary arising. So you and I are, you know, momentary arisings, which, like a film, you know, which is frames one after another, which look like it's a moving picture, but it's actually frames one after another. So we're moments after another. And the way a moment abides is in four parts. This is the way a moment arises and passes away. And it's just like also a human life seen as a whole has these same four stages, according to the tradition. So every moment is a whole life, but we can look at a life and say it also has these four stages. So here's the four stages of impermanence. Something initially arises, it abides, it decays, it goes away. Four stages. And in terms of a human life, those four stages would be something like birth, growth to full maturity, you know, where it's all going up, and then going down, aging, going down, and then you disappear, you die. So every human life has those four stages, but so does every moment. And so does the actualization of enlightenment. That's what this text is saying. But it's very odd because, according to the Awakening of Faith, the actualization of enlightenment goes in the opposite direction. Instead of starting with birth, abiding, decaying, stopping, it starts with stopping. For some reason, they explain it, but it's a little hokey, but it starts with stopping and then it goes through the four stages and ends with birth. I guess you wouldn't want enlightenment to end with stopping, right? You want it to end with, so it's nicer that way. Anyway, here's more or less what it says. This is my interpretation or my understanding of it. So the actualization of enlightenment has to begin with stopping, because it begins with your kind of recognizing that the way that you'd been thinking and feeling all along was really wrong, and you have to stop looking at it that way and stop doing that stuff, right? Which I think is kind of true. You start practicing and you start seeing, wow, you know, I got to do differently now. And this stage is characteristic, the text says, of, you know, kind of like not such swift monastics, people who follow the precepts and, you know, don't do bad things, but they don't really know what's going on. So it starts with stopping. The next stage is that you see that your thoughts are fleeting and ungraspable. You begin to notice, you know, your thoughts, which you thought were so compelling and so important, actually they come and go quite rapidly, and there's not a lot to them. Especially the thought that you are you, you realize what a flimsy thought that is, really. You see that. And this is the stage of monastics who have better insight than the first stage, but all bodhisattvas are in that stage. And this, as I say, is in the reverse order, identified with the stage of decaying or aging. But I think in this case, it doesn't mean decaying so much as it means coming to a kind of maturity, which would include, I think, a sense of sorrow, because one realizes that the whole setup here is really fundamentally riddled through and through with loss and impermanence. So that I can see where this is a level of, you know, decaying or maturing, because there's a lot of sorrow involved in this level of insight. That's what my interpretation anyway. So that's the second stage. The next stage, you see more deeply how profound it is that nothing at all abides. Nothing at all can be grasped or held on to, and so you can no longer really be caught by anything. And so this is the stage that's identified with abiding or coming to full strength. And it says that in this stage you recognize Dharmakaya, the true body of Buddha, which is this world. You see it as it really is. And the final stage, which in this scheme is birth, is when you see that all of this is eternal. And now you see the arising of everything that arises as it really is. It is identically and simultaneously passing away and eternal. And so there's a lot of joy here, and absolutely no more fear, because you realize that impermanence is permanence, and there is no loss. That loss is some sort of a halfway understanding. So that's a pretty lofty enlightenment right there. But then the text goes on to say, the truth of the matter is, there is no difference between the unenlightened person, whose mind is nothing but a stream of deluded thoughts, and the enlightened person, who may very well have the same thoughts. The only difference is that the enlightened person knows that which is free of thoughts, mind, which is original awakening, and knows to identify with that or include that, and is therefore fundamentally unaffected by all the deluded thoughts that might be coming right and left. So there's no difference, you know, between the two. The text also says that the four stages that it just so laboriously delineated are actually simultaneous. They're not stages at all. And they don't really exist. They're fundamentally empty, so don't get too excited about them, the text says. Now the awakening of faith goes back a step or two, and it starts to talk again about original enlightenment, which it says has two aspects. Purity of wisdom, A, and B, supra-rational functions. So purity of wisdom means that the person does good conduct. The person is diligent, the awakened person is diligent, practices all the time taking delusion and making it into enlightenment. But what does that mean? And the text explains. That means that in reality, of course, delusion is the same as enlightenment. There's no enlightenment that's different from delusion. How could that be? Because both enlightenment and delusion are illusory distinctions. They don't really exist. That's why you can't destroy delusion. You can't eliminate it or get rid of it. Because how could you get rid of something that was never there in the first place? And how can you not get rid of it since it wasn't really ever there? That's why there is really no difference at all between a person who is enlightened and a person who is deluded. And this is something Dogen says all the time. And it seems so baffling when you read it in Dogen, but here it's totally a reasonable point of view they're telling us. So when we think we're seeing an enlightened person who, in our mind, is different from an ordinary person, this is always going to be nothing other than a projection of our deluded mind. So, yesterday I was interviewed by someone, you know, about Buddhism. An interesting guy who does this, interviews all kinds of Buddhist people, and caught up to me somehow, and I talked to him. It was fun. And he said to me, "What is an enlightened person?" And I said, "An enlightened person is a person that other people think is an enlightened person. That is what an enlightened person is." Despite this, B, supra-rational functions also apply. This is the second part of awakening. This means that somehow the enlightened person, even though they're an ordinary deluded person, is going to be an important causal source to provide all sorts of conditions and situations that will help people. And such persons will be able to respond in a positive and helpful way to many different kinds of people and circumstances. Now, the way that that's what the text says. Now, the way that I understand this is that it cannot be talking about an individual person and that person's superpowers, because that wouldn't make any sense in terms of everything that the text has said so far. So it must be referring to a general sense of the miraculous and wondrous circumstances that do seem to arise, and I think we can all attest to this, or at least it seems like to us, that wonderful circumstances arise when there is a sphere of enlightened practice in the vicinity. In other words, we practice together and it just feels like, wow, you know, it's wonderful, it's miraculous, it's quite extraordinary. That's maybe an illusion, but it seems that way. And that is what the text is saying, is that that will happen. That's one of the effects of the arising, the actualization of awakening. So that's the end of points 1 and 2 of the discussion of the enlightened aspect of storehouse consciousness. Okay, now we come to the third part. The characteristics of the essence of enlightenment. And here there are 4 sub-points in the form of 4 mirror analogies. The Yogacara school and scheme often uses the idea of a mirror, that everything is a reflection in the mirror. Not real, a reflection. So often the mind is compared, mind with a capital M, is compared to space. It's just like space in that there's no boundaries to it. It really isn't anything in particular. Space isn't something in and of itself, and yet you need space for there to be anything. Nothing could exist without space. So mind is like space, but mind is also like a mirror that produces reflections. So here are the 4 points in the form of 4 mirror metaphors. 1, a mirror without any images. 2, a mirror that reflects everything as awakening, including defilement, and that uses these myriad reflections to encourage people to practice an awakening and awaken. And this is one of the most wonderful thoughts, I think, in Mahayana Buddhism. The idea that this whole universe, from top to bottom, is arrayed before us, spread out of the Buddha's compassion, so that we will have a place and a path toward awakening. That's what's reflected in the mirror. The third metaphor, a mirror in which there can be no defilement, that everything is reflected, everything that's reflected in it is always eternal and pure. And that's what we talked about a minute ago, the final stage of the development of actualization of enlightenment. And finally, 4, a mirror reflecting only objects that inspire us to goodness and freedom. So the world is here in all of its trouble to inspire us to goodness and freedom. So, for example, when we see all the suffering and we're moved by it and we want the world to be better, that's, from this point of view, that's the point of the suffering, to inspire us to goodness and freedom. So, to put all this in context of the outline of the text, to sum up here, we just finished the discussion about the storehouse consciousness, point A, its enlightened aspect, and next we will come to point B, its unenlightened aspect. And now, remember, so we haven't gotten to its unenlightened aspect yet. So remember, the storehouse consciousness, which is all of this that we've been saying, are sub-points to that, right? Is the first of 3 points in the discussion of mind in its phenomenal aspect, which is the second of 2 points of the 2 aspects of mind, right? Absolute and phenomenal. Okay, you got all that? Right? That makes sense. It's very clear, right? Okay, now I'm going to end by reading you 2 paragraphs from Suzuki Roshi, and then I'm done. And now, when you listen to these paragraphs from Suzuki Roshi, I will be very surprised if you don't hear these paragraphs and find pretty much everything that I've been talking about, or that the Awakening of Faith has been talking about, in these 2 paragraphs by Suzuki Roshi. Listen, and you'll hear it. It's very direct, directly right there. So Suzuki Roshi is saying the same exact thing. And these paragraphs are exactly where I left off on Saturday. These are the next 2 paragraphs from the ones I quoted on Saturday. So see if you don't hear that. Okay, this is Suzuki Roshi. It's page 20, I think, and 21 in the book, Becoming Yourself. Before you attain enlightenment, enlightenment is there. It's not because one attains enlightenment that enlightenment appears. Enlightenment is always there. And to realize this is enlightenment. If you think that enlightenment is some particular thing you can reach or attain sometime, you will be very discouraged because you will be seeking it. But if you feel that it is not possible to attain enlightenment, you will also be discouraged and will give up your practice, or will try to find some other teaching which is more worthwhile and can be achieved. In this way, you will move from one teaching to another and will have no time to realize your true nature, which is the true nature of everyone. So whether or not you realize your true nature or attain enlightenment is a minor problem. It's not the big problem. It's all the better if you do attain enlightenment. But even if you don't, there is no need to go looking for another teaching because the true teaching is always right here. This kind of understanding may be difficult to accept. You may give up if you don't think you have made some progress after practicing for 1 or 2 months, or maybe like 10 or 20 years, you might think. But true religion cannot be obtained by seeking for some good thing. That is only the way to attain something in a material sense. The way to work on spiritual things is quite different. Even to talk about spiritual things is not actually spiritual, but a kind of substitute. That you are here means that you will vanish. Things that exist are bound to vanish, and things which you attain cannot be perpetually retained. The only thing that exists forever is that which exists before anything else appears. As long as you seek for something, you will get the shadow of reality and not reality itself. Only when you do not seek for anything will you find it, and only when you do not strive for enlightenment will you have it. Because you try to attain something, you lose it. Doesn't that sound familiar? Right? Yeah. Suzuki Roshi is very profound, and he, you know, he's just talking, you know? He's not like going by a text. He's not like telling you what some text says. He's just saying, this is the way I see it. And I think the way he sees it is because of his long life of practice and his deep study and his looking at his own experience. It's the thing about Zen that is so great is it's always got to be about what you know yourself and what you experience yourself. And I think that what he's saying here is if you pay enough attention and you keep looking, you'll see what I see. You'll see it. Because we're all different and we all have different personalities and different insights and all of that. But fundamentally, we're all human. And so when it comes down to the fundamentals of human life, we're all going to see the same thing. And this is just him saying, this is how it looks to me. This is my understanding. Okay, well, thank you. That was great. You listened to all that. That was I'm so impressed that you can listen to all that. I mean, I don't think I would be able to listen to all that. You know, it's much better that I can, you know, like write about it and say these things. But listening to it, I would find it much more difficult. So, okay, now let's talk about something. We have time, I think, to get into groups of three. And Jeff is our host tonight. We can do groups of three. And I think like 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes with 3 minutes left over. About 15 to 18 minutes getting in and out of the groups. And here's my provocative topic. After all of this, does the idea of enlightenment or enlightenment have anything to do with your practice? Does enlightenment have anything to do with your practice? If so, what? How does it relate to you in the way you practice? And if not, what do you make of the fact that all these people are going on and on all the time about enlightenment? Why would they do that? Right? What are they talking about? If it's something that doesn't, you don't value or you don't think has anything to do with your practice, why do you think they're going on about this all the time? So that's, you can talk about anything you want, of course, but that's my suggestion for a topic that could be really meaty and interesting in your groups. So I'll say goodbye and see you in about 20 minutes. Please have great conversations and listen to each other and surprise yourself. You know, don't, obviously, we're not looking for correct answers here. We're looking for the truth, which means what you really and really, really think. So enjoy the groups and see you in about 20 minutes. Thanks, Jeff, for setting up the groups. I'll go away now.
Recording stopped.